Chapter 56. Isaac Bell seized James Dashwood by the scruff of his neck and threw him to Archie Abbott, who caught him on the run and whirled him farther up the riverbank like a lateral pass. He was reaching for Bell's hand when the bomb exploded. 20 paces, less than 100 feet, separated them from the blast. The shockwave crossed that distance in an instant, and the two friends saw a kaleidoscope of spinning trees as it slammed them off their feet and threw them after Dashwood. Ears ringing, they scrambled higher up the slope in an attempt as desperate as it was hopeless to escape the wall of water that they knew would burst through the exploded dam. When the wrecker heard the explosion, he knew that something had gone wrong. It was not loud enough. Not all the gelignite had detonated. He paused in his flight at a spot in the road where he could see the river down below in the canyon and watched anxiously for the moving wall of water the fallen dam would release. The river was rising. The water was definitely higher, but it was not what he expected, and he feared the worst. The partial explosion had only damaged the dam, not destroyed it. Hoping it had at least killed many detectives, he started back down the road, confident that eventually the dam would collapse and send a flood smashing into the bridge, whether it took minutes or hours. Suddenly, he heard the sound of a motor car, his Thomas Flyer, coming up the road. His face lit darkly with a pleased smile. The Van Dorns must have repaired the flat tire. Kind of them. Pistol in one hand, knife in the other, he quickly chose a spot where particularly deep ruts would force the car to slow.
"It's a miracle," said Abbott.
"A brief miracle," Bell answered. A torrent of water as big around as an ox was blasting through the hole the assassin's bomb had blown in the log and boulder dam. But the bomb Philip Dow had tried to kill them with hadn't detonated the rest of the charge, and the dam had held. At least for the moment. Bell surveyed the damage, trying to calculate how long the dam would last. A cataract was pouring over the top, and jets of water were blasting like fire hoses through cracks in the face. Abbott said,
"Dash, how'd you learn to shoot like that?"
"My mother wouldn't let me join the Van Dorns until she taught me."
"Your mother?"
"She rode with Buffalo Bill's Wild West show when she was young."
Bell said, "You can tell your mother you saved our bacon. And maybe the bridge. Hopefully that coal train will hold it."
"What's the matter, Archie?"
Abbott looked suddenly alarmed.
"But that was Kincaid's idea."
"What idea?"
"To stabilize the bridge with down pressure. Kincaid said they did it once in Turkey. Seemed to work."
"Kincaid has never done a thing in his life without purpose," said Bell.
"But Mowry and the other engineers wouldn't have allowed it if the weight of the train wouldn't help. I'd guess he knew the jig was up when he saw me ride up here, so he acted helpful to throw off suspicion."
"I've got to get down there right now."
"The horses scattered," said Abbott, "but there are mules in the stables."
Bell looked around for a better way. Mules trained to pull lumber carts would never ride them to the bridge in time to undo whatever the wrecker had set in motion with the coal train. His eyes fell on a dugout canoe on the riverbank. The water had already risen to it and was tugging at the front end.
"We'll take the Hell's Bottom Flyer."
"What?"
"The dugout canoe. We'll ride it to the bridge."
They manhandled the heavy, hollowed-out log on its side to spill out the rainwater.
"On the jump! Grab those paddles!"
They pushed the canoe into the river and held it alongside the bank. Bell climbed in front, ahead of the crosspiece the lumberjacks had stiffened it with, and readied his paddle.
"Get in!" "Hold your horses, Isaac," Abbott cautioned. "This is insane! We'll drown!"
"Amorous lumberjacks have survived the run for years. Get in!"
"When that dam lets loose, it'll sweep a tidal wave down the river that will wash over this canoe like a matchstick."
Bell looked back at the dam. The torrent that gushed from the hole that Dow had blown in the bottom was tearing at the edges.
"That hole's getting larger," said Abbott.
See the logs above it sagging?
He's right, said Dash. It could collapse any minute.
You're both right, Bell said. I can't risk your lives. Catch up when you can.
Isaac!
Bell shoved off from the bank. Abbott lunged to grab the back of the canoe. The current jerked it into the middle of the narrow torrent.
I'll meet you down there,
Bell called, paddling furiously to keep the current from smashing him into a rock.
Enjoy the mules.
The speed took him by surprise. The raging current drove the canoe faster than any horse and most automobiles. Hurtling along at this rate, he would be under the Cascade Canyon Bridge in 20 minutes. If he didn't drown. The banks were steep, the river narrow and studded with boulders. Fallen trees jutted into it. He overtook whole cut trunks floating along almost entirely submerged. The little canoe rowed up on one of them, and he started to overturn in a flash. He threw his weight the other way to right it. Then a tree that had been ripped from the bank by the flood rolled ponderously beside him, splaying the air with giant roots that reached for the canoe like tentacles. He fended them off with the paddle, then dug deep in the water, trying to outrun the flailing monster. A root whipped him in the face and nearly threw him out of the canoe. Paddling for his life, he pulled ahead of the rolling tree, dodged another boulder, slid between two more, and banged over a flat rock hidden under the surface. Then the canyon walls closed in, and deep water tore between them in a long, relatively straight run of several miles. This was better, and Bell began to think he might make it to the bridge intact. He looked back repeatedly. No sign that the dam had burst. The straight run ended in a series of sharp bends. The bends caused whirlpools that spun the canoe in circles that one man in the front of the canoe could not control. Bell concentrated instead on keeping the canoe upright and fending off rocks that were suddenly jumping out of nowhere. Floating out of the third bend backward, he looked over his shoulder to see where he was going. The canyon walls had spread wider apart, and the water had climbed onto a shallow bank that produced rock-strewn rapids. The current thrust him at the rapids. He paddled with all his strength to straighten out the canoe and head toward the deeper water of the original bed. But as soon as he had righted himself, he heard an ominous mutter that grew swiftly to a loud rumble. It sounded like a wall of water was rampaging after him. He looked behind him, expecting the worst. But the river was no wilder than before, which was wild enough. The dam, miles behind, was apparently still holding. But the rumble grew louder. Suddenly, Bell realized that the sound echoing off the steep canyon walls came from around the bend ahead of him. The current sluiced him through the bend in the river. He caught a glimpse of ropes tied to the trees on the bank. Then his eyes were riveted on what appeared to be a line across the river. But it was not a line. It was the clear break in the water where the river disappeared over a waterfall. The lumberjacks must have tied the ropes to hold when they climbed out of their canoes to carry them around the falls. Portage was not an option for Isaac Bell. The current had already accelerated and was throwing his canoe at the falls at 30 miles per hour. The rains saved him. At low water he would be dead, smashed to splinters on the rocks. The high water shortened the fall and cushioned his landing. He was still afloat, still flying along high and dry, when suddenly he was bearing down on an island-sized boulder that split the river in half. He dug in his paddle to steer around it. The stream rejoined on the other side of the boulder in a violent leap of spray and foam that battered the canoe on both sides. Then, against the darkening sky, he saw the airy arch and crisp straight line of the Cascade Canyon Bridge joining the two sides of the gorge. It was strange that the clearest description of its simple beauty was from the wrecker himself. It soared. It was hard to believe that any structure so large could look so light or span such a long distance. The coal train parked in the middle of it was 50 cars long, and yet there were empty stretches of track in front and in back of it. But the wrecker who so artfully described the Cascade Canyon Bridge was the man who would destroy it. Surely the wrecker knew a secret about the coal train that would gain him control of every major railroad in the country. Every act that Bell had seen him commit, every crime the wrecker had perpetrated, every innocent he had killed, told him that Charles Kincaid had tricked the Southern Pacific Company into parking that coal train on the bridge for a reason that would serve his monstrous ambition and vicious dreams. Moments later, Isaac Bell saw the lights of the town clustered along the bank under the bridge. He tried to paddle to shore, but it proved futile. The heavy canoe was firmly in the grip of the river. He raced by the outskirts of the town, and as the river narrowed and accelerated, he saw electric lights blazing on the piers and on the cofferdams and caissons built around them. 1,000 men and 100 machines were teamed to shore up the flow deflectors with tons of rock and raise the sides of the cofferdams with massive timbers to keep above the rising water. The river was sweeping Bell's canoe between the piers. No one noticed him coming, for the canoe looked little different than the many dark logs racing low in the water. Just as he thought he would be swept under the bridge and into the night, the canyon walls narrowed the river. Currents leaped crazily. The canoe was hurled sideways toward the pier farthest from town. It jumped over a tongue of stone jetty, spun wildly, and crashed against the wooden cofferdam. 50 exhausted carpenters spiking planks to the timber frame looked up blearily as Bell stepped briskly from the canoe and marched across the gangplank that connected the cofferdam to the stone pier it surrounded. "Good evening, gentlemen," Bell said, not pausing to answer cries of "Who? And where?" He spied a steel ladder affixed to the stone and started up it rapidly, calling an urgent warning down to the men below. "There's a flood crest coming down the river any minute. Build higher and be ready to run for it." 60 feet above the water, the stone stopped and the steel began. The pillar consisted of a square framework bolstered with triangles of girders, and it too had ladders. For painting, he presumed. From where he was standing on the top stones, the pillar looked to be as tall as the Singer Building he had seen in New York City, which Abbott once had boasted was 600 feet tall. Hoping that this was a case of a confusing perspective, Bell reached for the bottom rung. He felt the bridge trembling the instant he touched the ladder. It seemed to be shaking harder than when he'd run across it hours earlier. But not much harder. Was the coal train having the promised effect? Was it stabilizing the bridge? Baffled by the wrecker's intentions, Bell climbed faster. His wounded forearm where Dow had shot him was beginning to throb. He was less concerned by the pain, which was growing sharper, than by what it meant. He had a long way to go to the top of the bridge and needed all four limbs in working order. The higher he climbed, the shakier the bridge felt. How much worse would it shake without the added weight? He smelled smoke as he neared the top, which seemed odd since there were no trains running on the bridge. At last, the ladder topped out on a catwalk that traversed the steel arch and led to a shorter ladder to the deck. He hauled himself up the last few rungs and swung his legs onto the deck, where he found himself in the narrow space between the coal train and the open edge. His head was reeling with the effort, and he leaned over to rest, bracing himself with his hand on the gondola. He jerked his hand back with a startled shout of pain. The steel side of the gondola was hot. So hot, it burned his skin. Bell ran to the next gondola and touched it tentatively. It was hot, too. And now he smelled the smoke again, and he realized in a flash the diabolic trick the wrecker had pulled. So-called down pressure was stabilizing the bridge, as he had promised. But the vibrations from the water pounding the weakened piers were shaking the bridge. In turn, the bridge was shaking the train, which was shaking the coal. Deep inside 50 coal cars, thousands of pieces of coal were rubbing against each other and creating friction. Friction made heat, like a frontiersman rubbing two sticks to start a fire. Even as Bell realized the perverted genius of Kincaid's scheme, the coal ignited. 12 small sparks became 100 flames.
Soon 1,000 fires would mushroom through the coal. The entire train was smoldering on the middle of the bridge. Any second, the wooden cross ties under the train would catch fire. He had to move the train off the bridge. The staging yard was jammed with stranded trains and locomotives, but with no work to do, none of the engines had steam up. Bell spotted the big black Baldwin attached to Hennessy's special. It always had steam up, to heat and light the Pullmans and the private cars, and to be ready to move at the railroad president's whim. Bell ran to it. Every brakeman and yardman he saw, he ordered to throw switches to direct the old man's locomotive to the bridge. Hennessy himself, looking frail in shirt sleeves, was standing next to the Baldwin. He was breathing hard and leaning on a fireman's scoop. "Where's your train crew?" Bell asked. "I was keeping up steam before they were born. Sent every hand below to work on the cofferdams. Just had to catch my breath. Something's wrong. What do I smell? Is that fire on the bridge?" "The coal has ignited. Uncouple your engine. I'll pull the train off." With Hennessy directing brake and yardmen, who ran around throwing switches, Bell drove the Baldwin off the special, ran it forward, then backed it onto the bridge. Partway across, he coupled onto the lead coal gondola, while every man still in the yard worked to switch a path of rails to an isolated siding where the burning train could be safely moved. Bell shoved the Johnson bar forward and notched the throttle ahead, feeding steam to the pistons. This was the hard part. He had spent enough time in the cab to know how to drive locomotives, but driving and pulling 50 heavy gondolas were two different propositions. The wheels spun. The train did not move. He remembered the sand valve, which spread sand under the wheels to improve adhesion, and found its lever. Smoke was billowing from the gondolas now, and he saw flames start to shoot up. He reached for the throttle to try again. Suddenly, the wrecker spoke through the side window. "With what will you replace the weight?" he asked mockingly. "More coal?"